Three, two, one. The training world is full of technical editing courses that don't teach the high-end creativity that viewers expect. Inside the Edit was created specifically to teach you every single creative skill you'll ever need to mesmerize your audience. Hello, dear friends, and welcome back to the final episode of Once Upon a Timeline for 2021. Thank you so much for joining me, Paddy Bird, for another cracking show. On this last episode before the holiday break, we've got the concluding part of the hugely talented Carly Brown's interview. And let me tell you, it's fantastic. I know you're going to love it. She talks through a ton of really interesting subjects, from the mindset of high-octane promo editing on the Formula One circuit, to the move to assistant editing on feature films, and all the way up to getting her first big drama series, the second season of the BBC and HBO co-production Industry. Carly really is one to watch for sure, and her story is true inspiration. But first, let me catch you up on all the latest news from Inside the Edit. What a year it's been, dear friends. We've produced a ton of podcasts. We started our live bootcamp webinars. We launched the first ever online master's degree for creative editing. The last 12 months, you know, they really have been the biggest in Inside the Edit's history. And I have to say that we owe it all to you. Myself and the ITE team are just so grateful to be serving such a passionate and driven creative community. You know, the messages we get from you guys are really amazing. And it really gives us the motivation to create the best home for high-end editors. And I'm excited to say that next year, 2022, is going to be even bigger than this year for Inside the Edit, with some incredibly exciting things that we're putting together. At the start of the year, we're going to be releasing a ton of new tutorials on the site. We're also going to be launching the industry's first creative editing accreditation program. Yes, to sit alongside all your software accreditation, you'll be able to take a creative exam that shows producers and directors that you are certified in the art of editing and not just the software. We've also got a ton of great boot camps coming on a whole range of creative editing skills. We got free webinars to sign up to, two-week tasters for our creative editing master's degree that won't cost you a thing, and of course, weekly episodes of your favorite podcast, Once Upon a Timeline. We couldn't have done it without you, dear friends. Thank you so much for being part of the Inside the Edit community. Okay, it's time for the concluding part of our chat with the hugely talented Carly Brown. We left off last week where she was just starting to work in the highly pressurized world of sports promo editing. So we'll take it from there. It sounds like you had a massive step up there. I mean, I'm sure over the 3 years it was a kind of gradual thing and they acclimated you with not too much pressure at the start, but what you're describing, you know, I haven't worked in sports like that. I've done some sports stuff, but not anywhere near the level that you've done. But in terms of, like, I've done news, quick turnaround news, and I've done quick turnaround reality, and the intensity of when you've got, and you have to be on it for, it's like, there's no margin for error, is there? So how did you deal with that kind of thought process? Was that a massive jump into kind of from a psychological perspective? Did you really have to push yourself?
I guess, yeah, it did feel like there was a nice build up to it, because obviously I wasn't thrown in cutting the live sports stuff straight away. I think I built up to that for the first year. And they almost started me out. I remember my first kind of, you know, big live weekend was doing the Silverstone Grand Prix. And I think I was still an assistant editor then, but they had all their main editors in place, three other very experienced editors doing the main show. But they knew I was sort of, they wanted to give me an opportunity. So they gave me a smaller piece, you know, like a crowd VT or, you know, a Vox Pops with fans VT to cut, which... Actually, stuff changes so quickly in those kind of shows. The running order is constantly evolving, depending on the results of the race, who's available for interviews afterwards. There's always a chance. They basically would give me a VT that if I hadn't finished in time, it didn't matter. They can move things around to the running order, that sort of thing. So it kind of felt like there was a bit of pressure, but it wasn't the end of the world if I didn't do it in time, or if I wasn't ready, if I had a meltdown or something, because there were plenty of other people in place.
Yeah.
But obviously I was like, oh no, I want to get my VT in there. Yeah, so I was, you know, doing it. And I think I've learned to be fast as an editor, and, you know, you make it as good as you can in the time you've got. And when someone's shouting from next door, you know, how long till it's ready, and you kind of, you're given a, you know, well, you know, it needs to be ready by 5:30 and it's now 4:15. I'll do a quick pass at, and, you know, we're grading and doing a mix on these, you know, short, it might only be a 2-minute piece or whatever, but we basically play it out and then it goes on air straight away. So, you know, yeah, if I've got 15 minutes, I'll say, okay, great, I've got a bit of time. I'll do a quick grade on it, check the audio levels, and then I'm going to get them a safety version, and then I'll keep tinkering with it. And if I have time to get a slightly more finessed version, I'll send them a V2 or whatever. You kind of just got to... getting that mindset. And it's so funny because then some of the really experienced editors like to really push it and see how late they could leave it to get their edit out. And then one time one of them thought he'd sent the edit and it was about to go on air, and except the render hadn't worked or something, and it wasn't there, and they were like, oh my god, where is it? And he'd gone to the loo at that point because he'd been working solidly and hadn't had, you know, it was like, I've sent my edit, it's fine. It's like, oh no, it's gone wrong. So then I was in the next already, I had to jump on and try and help find where he'd put it or whatever. So it really gets your pulse going, that kind of like, is it going to make it to air? But it's great. It's amazing.
You see, what you're describing there, I think, would give a lot of traditional editors a heart attack. The big word that kind of jumped out there when you were describing that process was adaptability. Can you quickly change your mind, quickly change, like, okay, let's move this, and that's the difference between a lot of, like, you know, say drama or doc, and then the live environment. Okay, stop it, and you're having conversations with producers all the time and going, no, let's move this around. And having been in that myself, of like, hey, we're editing part three when part two has been transmitted to 10 million people right now, there's zero margin for error, what's going on, everyone's kind of shouting at each other, like, that requires, I mean, I haven't done that anywhere near the level that you've done it, but how do you prepare yourself for that kind of, I mean, it's high octane editing, isn't it? That's what it is.
It really is. And I think it's sort of like the Formula One. I'd done some UEFA Women's Euros a few years ago, where it was a similar thing, similar setup. And I'd be making the closer, which goes out at the end of the show. You tend to, like, the match would finish, and then, you know, there might be a bit of talk afterwards, but quite a lot of the time it might be go to an advert break, and then they come back and they want a 2-minute mini, you know, highlights of the game. But if they, you know, and you're building that throughout the match, but if there's a, like, some of those games, they kept scoring in the, like, 90th minute, or scoring a couple of times, and you know you've got 30 seconds to fit the whole match in to your little kind of closer VT, and you've already finessed that nicely with a few other little goals or whatever, you know, like chances from earlier, and then suddenly you're like, oh my god, I need to cut half of this and get two goals in here, and you're always waiting for there was a bit of a delay on the nice, you know, the nice slow-mo shots coming
and
all the producers are like, oh, wait for those, but then you're like, well, I'm not going to have an edit ready if we don't just put something in and go. And it's sort of like that thing of editing something as it's evolving. Like you say, you know, part three is going out, part four, you're trying to, it's still happening, and you don't know what's going to happen. Oh, you know, a big crash in Formula One, it's like, okay, that's going to totally, like, my whole timeline is going to change.
It's not a reflection of what's actually happened, because it could be you may have a bottleneck of action in the last 2 minutes of the game or whatever. I mean, that must just be... I just talking about it now. I can feel myself getting a bit tense.
I'm actually getting tense as well, and I do remember.
I'm bringing
it
up
was
bad
tense.
Memories for you, Carly. I'm really sorry.
The only way you can prepare yourself is just be as organised as you can in the lead up to it. I think once you know footage is coming in and stuff's happening really quickly, your time, you know, your project might become a bit of a mess because you don't have time to be organised. But I think being organised beforehand, you know, I would make sure my sound effects library, everything's there. It's really easy for me to, it's a football match. I know what I'm going to be looking for if I'm using any sound effects in some of this stuff. And you do want to try and make it as, you know, craft something as creative as possible, even though it's, you know, sports and it's sort of just a review of what happened. We were at Whisper always trying to do a bit more and make it as extra creative and interesting as possible. So, yeah, anything from sound design, you know, I wouldn't necessarily do the graphics, but there might be graphics teams working alongside. So you would also be mindful that you would be exporting out really, you know, beautiful shots to send to them for them to do some work on to then come back into your edit just to add an extra edge to something or, you know, just even having an idea of a grade, like build a look for the piece beforehand. And then you're basically just going to use that layer across it all, tweaking little bits and pieces. So I guess that kind of preparation is useful. But then essentially you're just waiting for stuff to happen. And then as it happens, just trying to be as on it. And I'm not doing it by myself. I have a producer or a director who will be there. You know, either making a log or suggesting which moments go in. It's not all totally on the editor, but you do have to be on it, and it is stressful, but really exciting. And I'm so glad I've done that style of editing. I wouldn't want to do it all the time, but it's great, and it's really fun. And the sense of kind of triumph at the end when you've done, you know, you're quite pleased with your piece and it's gone out, and you know, everyone comes and says, "Oh, well done! That was a great piece, and what a great race," or whatever. It's sort of like that environment. It's not quite been the same ever since, especially in drama, because it's like, is it finished yet? Is it finished yet? Okay, we've locked. Oh no, they still want to make changes. It's gone to the grade. Oh no, we've unlocked again. And it's sort of like, you're never quite done with it, basically, until it's then done. And then it's almost like in a post house, in the online somewhere. Whereas, yeah, nice to be the person who is the last one to watch it through before it goes on TV. That's a great feeling.
Well, I mean, this is the thing. That's what's really fascinating. You've just highlighted the difference in two completely different genres in the workflow and the process and stuff like that. And again, it sounds like, I mean, I don't think I've ever heard of anyone going from high octane live sports promo cutting to drama. I mean, I want to know how did that happen? Was it when you were cutting all that stuff? Obviously, it was high octane. It was really fun traveling around the world. It was a really great life, and you were really with a fantastic production company. Was there a little knocking at the back of your head throughout all of it, going, you know what? Drama, that's where I want drama, because drama is not easy to get into, and you obviously reached the top of this particular genre. What was that transition? Was it a conscious thing? Were you always trying to knock on that door separately? You know, talk me through that, because I've never heard of that transition between that genre and that genre. That's utterly fascinating.
Yeah, it was a bit of a jump, and I you know, that's very kind of you to say, but I sort of top of my game in sport, I still feel like I was, you know, I was dealing with those situations and I was pleased with what I would do, but I still felt I was surrounded by some brilliant, experienced, you know, sports editors and, you know, quite a few people who had done Top Gear but also do sport and, you know, the crossover between the sort of more entertainment shows as well.
Yeah.
And I realised I had loads more to learn in that world as well. You know, I was only just getting in there, and I was cutting stuff and it was going on air, and they were starting to do some documentaries as well. So I did do a Channel 5, like a football documentary, along with other editors. But, you know, I was, you know, editing on that. So I realised I wasn't, you know, I was loving what I was doing, but I felt I did have more to learn. But I was kind of exactly as you're saying, I was sort of looking at the other editors that I was working with, who all love sport and loved watching sport and, you know, were living their dream because essentially they're being paid to do what they love. And I've never actually really loved sport. Like, it's not something I would ever watch. And I sort of fell into this because of doing that London Olympics thing, which at the time was like, well, I'm still a student and I'll sort of, you know, it's a great event to be part of. But then it's funny because then one thing leads to another, and I can see, you know, if I stayed in this role and in that company, I would keep going down a path that, was hard to come back from, especially as the, you know, you become more established, you start to earn more, you are, you know, you're a sports editor and you're seen as that. And I could tell, I sort of got the sense that that was going to be difficult to come back from. And I did always have that thing in the back of my mind that I want to work in drama. And, you know, back from uni, I was making my period dramas and medieval dramas. That was what I loved doing. And so, yeah, it kind of reached a bit of a climax of, you know, what am I going to do? Am I going to keep doing this? And it's, you know, I love the people I work with. You know, I'm in a good job here. Or do I want, is it not too late? Do I want to go into drama now? And so very luckily, and also sort of, I'm still grateful for this same production company put me forward for the Edinburgh TV Festival's Wands to Watch scheme, which is kind of helping people in their, when they're, you know, 5 years into their career, but they're maybe at a crossroads of kind of like where they're going to go next. And, you know, quite a few people apply for this scheme, and I was very lucky to get on it, you know, with their recommendation. And I had to do an interview and sort of write various pieces about, you know, where I want to go, but also about my thoughts on the state of the industry. And it's very much focused more on production and sort of pre-production, actually. They did take another editor my year, but it's quite rare for them to take editors. So I was sort of surrounded, you know, 30 of us went to Edinburgh TV Festival and had all these bespoke sessions from, you know, people like Jay Hunt and various other, you know, channel controllers. It was really useful for kind of seeing the wider industry and you know, how things work and commissioning, kind of getting a taste of all of that stuff. But one of the sessions was about breaking into high-end drama. And they basically sort of suggested, I talked to one of the speakers afterwards, and I'd sort of heard this already, but hearing it from her was really useful. She basically said, you know, to get into drama as an editor, you probably do need to be an assistant again. And it's obviously a step back. But, you know, no one is going to look at your credits, even if they're broadcast credits for BBC. And, you know, I'd done some for Amazon by then. I'd done some stuff for, yeah, Channel 4, Channel 5. But it's not relevant to drama. It was just I was never going to be able to jump across.
It takes some guts and determination, and it's like jumping off a cliff again, isn't it? Is this going to work? Turning your back on what's comfortable. And that's the freelance life, isn't it, really?
It is, and it was scary. And I did,
I bet.
Yeah, I handed in my notice at Whisper without anything to go to. And they were really lovely. They actually wanted to try and book me freelance straight away just to come back in to do, you know, they were like, oh, we'll give you a few days here and there. And I can see that they were kind of trying to book me up. And
that's really cool of them.
Yeah, I had just joined an agency called Jump Cut, which is run by a brilliant editor who also, you know, gets jobs as an agent for other people. And he was finding me sort of commercial or corporate work straight away. So I wasn't totally going to nothing, but none of it was dramatic stuff. So I was basically just saying no to everything at this stage in a slightly crazy move of like, okay, I'm just going to give it a go. And I suppose worst case, if it doesn't work out, I can go back to some of these things, but I'm going to hold out. And I kind of, we know how it works. Stuff comes up so quickly and they kind of want you to start straight away. And so, yeah, I was offered one job with like a watch brand for, it was like 12 weeks editing or something, and at a really good rate and a day rate. And it's sort of like, okay, I could go do that. But then 12 weeks, I can't do drama. You know, that's a big chunk of time again taken out. So, yeah, I was kind of turning down all these jobs. And my partner, who has always been brilliantly supportive, was still being supportive, but I feel him and my mum and dad are a bit like, what is she doing?
You got to pay the rent.
I know, exactly. So yeah, it was a slightly stressful time, but luckily it did work out. And I sort of booked to go away on holiday, which was probably risky given my financial situation. But I was thinking, okay, I'll break from Whisper, I'll go on holiday. And just before I went on holiday, I spent a whole day emailing drama editors or drama editors' agents, because I couldn't always get their details. So I was sort of just emailing agents and saying, please, can you pass on this note to this editor? I love their work, and I'd just love to meet them for a coffee or something. Again, this was all pre-COVID, so it felt like a good way to go, at least to try and just make some contacts. So I didn't really know anyone in that world at all. And so I sent out quite a few of these. I think I kind of, you know, it's like applying for your first job. You send out loads of CVs to loads of production companies. I kind of thought, this seems to be a world where it's all about who you know. And, you know, I was told there are a lot, you know, there's a lot of jobs in assisting. You know, I wasn't asking for an editing job. I was just asking for either a chat or if they need assistance. So I kind of thought, well, you know what, let's just email loads of people and hope for the best. Think, you know, I just need one to come off. And I didn't really hear back anything to start with. And then I think it was like 5 days later when I was on holiday, I just got this call out the blue from one of the editors I'd emailed, an amazing editor called Una Niganila, who has worked on The Crown and won a BAFTA for Three Girls. And she had, I think she was just done Stan and co-edited Stan and Ollie and loads of other amazing things. She was sort of my top editor on my list. She just rang me up out of the blue and was like, Carly, I loved your email. I love that you've done all this other editing bits. And I am actually looking for an assistant. I'm editing a Keira Knightley film and we need an assistant to start in 2 weeks. Do you want the job, basically? I literally, I was like, ah.
Fantastic.
And I was like scribbling down the details as she said them, you know, like the name of the film and all this stuff. Like, I still have that piece of paper, which is like the back of a receipt for something where I was like, quickly write things down.
This was the moment.
Honestly, it really felt like that. And
how cool.
And I feel like I probably had a little cry off that call because it was sort of just like that little lifeline into, you know, someone taking a chance on me. Because, most of those editors, absolutely fair enough, they're busy people. And, you know, they didn't reply. Well, a couple of them did, actually, and I had a coffee with a couple. But just that kind of a job out of nowhere. It was technically a trainee assistant. That was the pay. But they managed to get me the credit of a second assistant. And the film was Misbehaviour, which was a Pathé film that came out last year with Keira Knightley, Keeley Hawes, great cast. And so, I start on that basically almost straight away. So I'm glad I kept myself free because it was a bit of a one-off offer, basically. And that was I was suddenly on a film. And, you know, I was working with a first assistant who was brilliant. She's now editing. And then Una. And we were in cutting rooms in Molinaire, which when I was in my post house as a runner, we always liked Molinaire because it felt like we'd drop tapes off at Molinaire. And it was always like, this is a cool place to work. So it was actually a real
Molly's
dream to go back in. Exactly. It's like, oh, I'm back as an assistant, which, was brilliant. And I kind of learnt everything I need to learn on that film. Like, Izzy Curry, who was the first assistant, brilliant, did a brilliant job of sort of training me. And I did know Avid, but the workflow was so different to anything I'd ever come across in a drama. So that was a shock.
What were you cutting on with all your sports stuff? Was it Premiere or Final Cut or...?
It was Premiere, I'd used Avid for a couple of things, but mostly it was Premiere. And I guess just all of the stuff I worked on, mostly, so there was, when I was moved up to editor, they did bring in another assistant, but they kind of weren't as involved as closely in the editors as perhaps in drama when the assistant is working, you know, to that editor. And even things like, well, like I've said, we would grade and mix our own work a lot of the time, and we would just work, you don't work with proxy files, you just work with whatever they've shot and you don't relabel anything. So there was a whole stage of the assistant's job in drama, which was totally new to me. I'd never, you know, even I seen anything like that before. I had actually met up with someone I met through Facebook who was another assistant editor, a lovely lady called Aideen, who offered to, we met in a Pret and she showed me the workflow before I started the job because I was like, I don't know anything. And that was still one of the most useful things ever, just understanding how it works because it was just a totally different world to anything I'd done before.
It's a much bigger job in drama, isn't it?
I guess it possibly depends on the editor and the drama, or whether it's film or TV or whatever, but for Misbehaviour, you know, Una was brilliant as an editor for kind of encouraging us to do cuts ourselves, so we were still getting to do assemblies, and sometimes she'd come in and say, you know, oh, the execs want to try this, but the director thinks this, so can you guys cut a few different versions of it so that, you know, other things to show them. So that was brilliant because I was like, oh, great, I'm getting to do a little bit of editing as well, which is obviously what I want to be doing eventually. A lot of it was sound design, like sort of track laying and, you know, specifically, I think I learned from Una the importance of even like little bits of ADR that we'd record ourselves. You know, I knew sound design was important beforehand, but things like we'd record it on our phones and just put it into the edit, which is then it would be done properly in the mix. But, you know, little breaths here and there, or extra little lines of ADR, or background crowd noises. Sort of, I learned how important all of that stuff was for kind of creating you know, a real life drama, especially if they've only had so many crowd on location, or, you know, all those little details that you can add in the edit, in the sound design. And then VFX, I hadn't really had to do much VFX before. So, you know, comping TV screens, putting things picture in picture, and then, you know, masking people out. I guess all of these kind of skills Izzy taught me, and I realised that was a big part of the job. And that was fun, because that was, you know, those are the more creative sides of the assisting role. There was then, obviously, they'd finish a shoot, so I wasn't involved in the doing the rushes, kind of organising the scene bins, but I was there for all of the turnovers when the film finished, and we were, you know, handing everything over to the sound and grade, yeah, and the visual effects teams. And that's obviously a massive process, and, you know, really, for, you know, the film was an hour and a half or however long, it's a big job to get that ready. And then we have more notes, and then it changes again, and then it goes back to everyone. So, you know, the organisation and the kind of attention to detail, I think I did have all of that from previous work, but it kind of became apparent that to be a good assistant, you needed to be really, you know, focused, and the details matter, and every shot counts. And Una would know every shot, you know, by frames by the end of, like, whether, you know, if something has slipped, she would know. And so, and I would obviously, you know, I think maybe one occasion that had happened, and I was like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. Yeah, that was an accident. And you kind of just had to, if something's gone wrong, own up to it straight away or whatever. It was, you know, it was sort of a bit overwhelming, but they were, again, it was a lovely team of people, and I loved the film. So it was a great place to learn all of that.
I mean, one of the things I'd love to know is, like, you went from high octane to kind of low octane, really, didn't you? Like, I remember when I came, because I started off in reality TV, you know, Big Brothers and X Factors and all that kind of stuff, and just bam, 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 that same kind of bam, 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 bam. And then when I got my job on my first documentary, and I was like, okay, yep, great, let's cut it. And the director was like, there's no deadline here. I mean, there is, but it's not for weeks. So do you want to just chill out? And so I had to kind of slow myself down to a kind of more cerebral, you know. Did you have anything like that, that kind of transition from high speed to low speed?
I guess I did. The thing with Una is that she sort of works at an incredible pace and has such passion and energy, and kind of will come. She does work at 100 miles an hour.
Right.
So even though we did have ages, you know, I was on it, I joined it in April and I finished in August. So, you know, for that period of time, you know, we're still working on the same thing, in a sense. But I think learning from her and her, the way she works, she would come in and she would sort of need everything already. Like, she would be like, oh, and can I have this? And can I have this? And I think that was great, because I think she's just so on it, that made my experience working in those other high pressure environments meant that I could deal with that and be able to. And she wasn't, you know, she was lovely about it. And I think she would always be like, you know, don't rush it. But I think her attitude as an editor was, well, let's get it as quick done as best and as quickly as possible to get it to the director, or the director in the room, you know, we would just want to have those options ready. And so I think that fast pace was still encouraged. And I've then worked, gone on to assist other editors who are not as, you know, sort of energetic in that sense. But it totally suited me, that style of working. And I was sort of, I guess, because I was getting to grips, you know, with the workflow and, you know, the massive project. We were all working in one project, because obviously in Avid you could do that, whereas I'd been used to just working my own projects in Premiere, whereas we were working in Una's project, but, you know, in separate bins or whatever. Just kind of getting my head around all of that. Yeah, I think I appreciated that there was a bit of a slower pace, but it didn't feel that much of a change. And I think we were at that, they'd done the director's cut and they were onto the fine cut. And I guess that's the point where the execs are dropping in sort of whenever. And it was, there were quite a few different execs from various, you know, companies involved with that film. So it was, you know, I did feel like there was always pressure. And there were times where, yeah, both of us as assistants would feel like, oh, should we grab lunch? Okay, but we really should run and run back, because the execs might be arriving and we want to be there to support Una. And if they ask to see, you know, even if it's like pulling up the composer's work from 3 weeks ago, we need to be on it, and because the pressure is on. And not every day and not all the time. There were definitely times where I was a bit more relaxed, and I suppose as the assistant, once the film is locked, you are just overseeing the turnovers and you've got to be really on it. But the deadlines, you know, you're more in control of the deadlines, whereas I think, you know, that fine cut stage and, you know, just getting to picture lock is quite tense. And, you know, there were quite a few late nights and a few, you know, we would be screening at Mr. Young's in Soho quite often. So, you know, just getting the export ready. Exactly. It was, you know, place of dreams. And that was always a little tense, you know, just getting everything ready and checking it. So I suppose the pressure did feel always on, but that was fine. I loved that. And it was a great way to learn. So yeah, it was a totally different world, but they're not that different. And, you know, I'm glad I came to it that way round, I think, having done the faster paced stuff and then coming into drama. Because even I was then thinking in the back of my mind, why are we all stressing about this? We've got ages. Like, why is, you know, compared to what I'm used to doing, why do we need to stay really late and do it today? But I think there are almost so many more options in a drama and so many ways of doing it. You know, comes back to sort of things I was saying earlier, for the, you know, you're not just making the best of what you've got. You've got so many different takes. You know, I had learned editing in a world where you just make the most out of what you've got. And, you know, the sports stuff, that Formula One crash, they have it on all these different camera angles, but that's all they've got. You know, they can't make it happen again. So that's what you've got to work with, essentially. And then it was so strange, and obviously it makes total sense that that's how it works, but coming into drama and, you know, each scene, you've got all the camera angles and all the takes and the different variety in performance and kind of, you know, how you craft something, and then, you know, you can restructure and move the scenes around. All of that stuff, I guess I kind of learnt through, you know, starting work with Una on that film and seeing the cut change. You know, when I started, the film was quite a bit longer, and then what gets cut, and then the balance of, you know, doing a pass on a certain character if, you know, a character's not coming across in the best possible way, or actually they're coming across too well and you actually want the audience to dislike them or to be suspicious of them. You know, the idea of going back through the rushes and looking for those moments which will very subtly change your perspective of that character. That was all new to me, and I guess I kind of, I don't know if I knew that would be, I suppose I did know that would be part of that job, but it was really interesting to come in on something, especially with such a brilliant established editor and assistant editor in Izzy, and to kind of learn that in a really, like, quite small and, you know, safe environment in a way, because they were, I was technically the trainee, so I could just, you know, I wasn't given too much responsibility, but by the end I was actually given a fair amount of responsibility, and there were days where, you know, Izzy went off to actually get married, so I was left with a bit of, you know, left in charge of the cutting room at times. And, you know, it was, they did bring another first assistant in to help finish it off, but I was kind of the one who knew more about the film at that stage, so it was, you know, it was brilliant. And Una was great for sort of saying, well, you're an editor already and you're assisting now, but, you know, keep pushing towards that next step, because you don't want to be an assistant forever. And I was, yeah, absolutely, I don't want to be an assistant forever, but I do hear of people being assistants for a long time. And so I guess I always had in the back of my mind, okay, I've got to keep thinking, how do I step up the next level in this genre, which I, you know, I've wanted to work in and I'm now in, but technically I'm a second assistant, like, how do I get to that next stage? And, you know, once again, Una was brilliant for that, because we just happened to be working down the corridor from the Crown, who were in the cutting rooms there as well. And lovely Una put in a good word with them to get me on the next series. I handed my CV as well, but I think it was her recommendation, effectively, that got me onto that job, you know, shortly after. And that was obviously another kind of big jump. I managed to get the job of a block assistant on that, which was sort of like a first assistant, but just for your episodes. So it was kind of like a step up, but there was an overall series assistant who was overseeing everything. So it wasn't full responsibility, but it was, you know, a step up the ladder again. And a great, you know, great credit. Everyone's heard of it, even if they don't like it.
Amazing credit. Yeah. That's like one of the biggest shows around at the moment globally, isn't it? Everyone knows it.
Yeah, and it was, you know, great for that. And I suppose with that comes, you know, you're quite a small cog in that, you know, it's a very big team. But then I felt like I kind of imagined, you know it's such a big global show. It was really weird to then go on to that. And yeah, there's 10 episodes, each have their own editor, and then there are a few of us assistants, and that, you know, obviously all the producer, directors and execs. But, you know, the hub of it was, you know, us a little edit team in Soho again. It's like this massive show just comes out of here. But I mean, I know the crew and the production, obviously, there's hundreds of people involved in that. But that's what I loved, that hundreds of people on those shoots. And then it comes back to like a really core team of people to kind of put it together in the edit. And it was amazing to be part of that.
It's kind of crazy, isn't it? It's like you're sitting alone and with your small editing team and looking at this footage and cutting it together. But then if you actually go out onto the set, you're like, oh my God, I'm overwhelmed by this. Like, I've got a friend of mine who's just about to start cutting a very big Hollywood movie. And we were joking about it. And I was like, and this is a couple of hundred million. And he was saying, don't you get like, and it's his first big jump. I think he's done like a 70 million before. And I said, aren't you going to be, you know, he goes, if I go down on set, I'm going to absolutely be terrified. But at the end of the day, it's performance, nuance, the psychology of everything that's going on screen. And I'm in my little room and, you know, yes, every single shot costs 50 grand as opposed to 1 grand or whatever, or 2 grand. And keeping your mind in that space, you know, I've never had to deal with, you know, dealing with a couple of hundred million pounds, the responsibility that goes with. I mean, that I just can't even get my, that's astonishing. But all the patterns of what we do as artists, they're all kind of the same, really, aren't they? It just looks better, the performances are bigger, the da-da-da-da-da, you know, all that kind of stuff. So there must be a nervousness, like, going into that, but then at the same time, oh, yeah, it's just our little team in a post house in Soho.
Yeah, and separate it out. And actually, like, sadly, I never got to go to set for The Crown, but yeah, I think, you know, maybe that would have been overwhelming, and maybe you don't want to know how much is involved. I mean, you see it on screen, yeah. Obviously. You see the cost and the man and woman power behind it.
Oh,
but yeah, you've got to almost ignore all that and just, you know, watch the rushes for what they are and you know, do your job from there. But yeah, it did feel a bit overwhelming. That first day, you know, seeing Olivia Colman's face on my screen, and as the assistant, the rushes. So this was my first time ever doing rushes. And, you know, I was I feel like I got quite lucky even with this step, because I was a bit like, oh God, I don't know if I know enough about this to be doing this. But, you know, I picked it up and it was fine. And there was a lovely, you know, the other assistants were so helpful. And, you know, it was straightforward enough, but, you know, just getting the footage comes to you first as the assistant. You're the one going through everything and checking every shot, checking against the paperwork to see if it's all there. And, you know, we've got it all covered, and, you know, then handing it all over to the editor. Yeah, it was brilliant. Yeah, seeing Olivia Colman on my screen, I was just like, oh, my God, this is so cool. So overwhelmed. I still get excited. One day this is going to go, but I still get excited by this sort of thing.
Having that excitement, you know, it's getting to work on something like that and seeing that. I mean, you're probably the first person on the planet to watch that raw footage. You know, it comes out from the DIT and then goes through that process, and then you get to see it before anyone else. Like, oh, that's a nice little moment, isn't it? That must be like, oh.
It's great. Yeah. It's yeah, you do feel, I feel quite powerful. But then it's difficult, because then I was watching it, and then I guess part of me is like, oh God, I wish I was cutting this. But then also I'm thinking, oh God, I wouldn't even know where to start with some of this. And again, I was assisting two brilliant editors who had very different styles of how they worked, but it was sort of great to be in with them, and they were really inclusive, sort of, you know, as well as all the assistant jobs, asking me, you know, to watch their work, and we'd have discussions about stuff, and they were so supportive.
That's so
in
cool.
terms of kind of including you.
Yeah.
Which was great. And I learned a lot from that. And the process, I guess, yeah, coming to something which was TV instead of film, it was good to see that side of it. Although I do feel like The Crown, like, lives in a separate world, sort of budget-wise, and, you know, what they can get away with compared to a lot of other TV shows. So maybe it wasn't the most accurate representation of TV and drama in general.
It's so big budget and so high end, and so, I mean, it's just like a phenomenon, isn't it, really? It's like the production design, the costume, everything is just, it's just, you know, right up there with the biggest feature films.
Yeah, completely. So it was, you know, brilliant to have all of that. And you know, there were certain episodes where I guess I didn't really know whether this was the case or not in TV drama, but they'd actually shot it all and sort of had a cut in place. And then Peter Morgan, the showrunner, wasn't sure it was working, so wrote additional scenes and they would then shoot those. And I guess that's where maybe some dramas that would be the norm, but a lot of dramas, you know, again, you maybe don't have the budget to start reshooting extra stuff at that stage. So it was interesting to sort of see how that worked and, you know, how they slotted in and you know, that whole process, you know, getting it across the line. And then COVID happened just as we were basically locking my two episodes. Then we all moved home, worked from home, you know, picture locked both episodes working from home, which was actually fine. You know, they were great. They were very organised and, you know, we all got our own equipment sent to us, so it worked fine. But, you know, that was a different challenge in itself, I suppose. But, you know, we got there and, again, brilliant, lovely team of people. We had Zooms for most of the last year, like catching up with everyone in the editorial team and still see quite a few of them now. So, yeah, it was a great experience, but it did still leave me thinking, okay, great, now what? What do I want to do next? How do I step up to get closer to being the editor? Which, once again, my guardian angel, Una, was the one who was helped me. Although last summer I did then go back to freelance editing and did some other random bits and pieces, like I ended up getting a job through LinkedIn, which I didn't think LinkedIn was necessarily for our industry, but I've kept mine up to date over the years and I've had a few odd jobs through there. So I was, a producer got in touch wanting some YouTube videos done for Rob Brydon, who was launching his own YouTube interview channel.
Wow.
So I ended up cutting those for quite a lot of last summer as editor, which was great. And it was, you know, sort of working with Rob, although indirectly.
Comedy. Good comedy,
yeah.
He's
know.
Brilliant.
Yeah, they were fun. They were great. And he was interviewing like Will Ferrell, Ruth Jones, Stephen Merchant. So I was basically just like had more famous people on my screen, even though they were just Zoom interviews. They were great. They were really fun to do. And it was nice to go back into editing for a bit in the middle, remind myself that I could still do that as well as assist. So that was great. But then Una, yeah, back to Una, she ended up getting me the job of her first assistant on a feature film called Belfast, which was Kenneth Branagh's next project. And that sort of started last summer. And so very luckily, I kind of jumped up to being a first assistant, which was a kind of another good step on the ladder, I suppose. Again, sort of going into it being a bit like, oh, not sure I know enough to be the first assistant on a feature film.
Imposter syndrome.
Always. But I don't think I did. I'd done two jobs in drama and I was a bit like, you know, I've got this far. And I understood how the process works. I guess you always just think new things are going to come up in any job that you might not know the answer to, especially in a technical role, which assisting quite often, you know, you're the one people go to for all sorts of technical stuff. And I was a bit like, I don't know if I'll know how to do all of this stuff, but at least I have a good set of people I could ask about now. I've got contacts from the other jobs. And so I was kind of like, okay, I've got to go for it, even though it does feel a bit of a jump. So I went on to working on Belfast for 6 months as first assistant. And again, working with Una, I got to do a bit of cutting, sort of assembling some scenes for her or alongside her. She would work on them, but I would work on them too as a sort of a different option to watch. And then I was working directly with Kenneth Branagh. We went into sort of the second wave lockdown around this time. We were supposed to be working in a studios all together, but we all ended up working from home. So Una's back in Ireland, I'm here in London, and then we set Kenneth Branagh up with his own Avid in his home so that he could watch stuff from home and watch cuts from home. And so I was responsible for having to teach him how to use Avid so that he could review things. So I had to give him like a 2-hour lesson, me like teaching
JKL.
Him the basics. Honestly, I was like, you know when you've done something for so long and you know what the shortcuts are, but if you actually have to explain it to someone else, you're like, oh, hang on, how do I do this? What do I press? And then it's like Sir Kenneth Branagh there and I'm trying to act like I know what I'm doing. And he was, you know, very technical. He was very on it. So I think it was kind of like trying to get the right level of, you know, he wasn't going to be doing the edit himself, but he wanted to watch rushes and mark the bits he liked. And he wanted to, the idea was I'd remote in and put cuts into a bin for him and render it for him so he could just press play. So it was just, you know, the basic stuff, but it was kind of like, okay, how do I make this simple but also not be really patronizing? Because he obviously is like a very established director as well as actor, and you know, knows what he's doing around a camera department, so he probably does sort of know what he's doing in an edit, but also I don't want to totally flummox him. So that was an interesting experience, but I think it went well, and it worked. Yeah, we again, that was a whole film we basically locked in lockdown.
Wow.
And it, yeah, that was again a totally different experience, but quite bizarre but fun.
And so when did that end? Where are you at now? What's the latest?
So that ended in February, and off the back of that I had a couple of other job offers to go on to be an assistant again. But I was kind of at the stage, I was like, okay, I loved that experience, but I really don't want to be assisting anymore. I really do just want to be editing. And if that meant taking work not in drama for a while, just to do a bit more editing again, I was kind of fine with that. So straight off the back of that, I did end up editing. They're doing quite a bit of live theatre, like streamed live theatre over the last year. And I ended up working on a project, again, through LinkedIn. The place to get your jobs, apparently.
Wow.
I ended up working with a producer on a production called Him, which went on Sky Arts, and it was Adrian Lester and Danny Sapiani in a theatre show which was supposed to have an audience in, but they couldn't have the audience in, so it was all done on the cameras over various nights. I got access to all the night's recordings, all the cameras, and I was doing a cut of kind of the best bit. So it was sort of like doing a drama, just in a theatre environment. It was great because there was no audience in the way. They could get in there with the Steadicams and like get much better angles than the normal like wide shots that you get in a theatre recording. So it felt really dynamic and really fun. So there was that. I edited that, and then I've been editing. Actually, Whisper have been great at having me back to do the odd day here and there doing sport again. So I've been doing some of that editing. But the main sort of jump for me was back in March time, I managed to get a drama agent who I managed to sort of, I was introduced to by someone, a friend of a friend. Again, it's these sort of random chats of reaching out to people. And somebody, a brilliant editor called Sarah Jones, introduced me to my agent. And they took me on, again, sort of saying, we're not sure you've got quite enough drama experience yet, but it's a busy year, and you know, you've proved yourself in other genres and you've got some good credits, so we'll take you on our books. And very recently I found out she's managed to get me a job editing two episodes of a BBC HBO drama, so I finally kind of got my jump up, I suppose. Well, for this one, they always say it's hard to get the next drama editing job. I don't know, I'm just taking it one step at a time, and this is kind of like my dream job, going on to this project, which unfortunately I can't say what it is yet, but it's really exciting, and you know, I'm just really chuffed to be finally kind of in the editing seat, I suppose.
We are witnessing history in the making here. I mean, it's so beautiful to hear that actually this is not like 5-10 years ago, Carly. This is like what you're doing right now, and the last, and especially with COVID and where you've been and how you've transitioned from one genre to another. It's just, that's an utterly fascinating story, and that I think it gives, you know, listeners out there the inspiration, certainly inspiring me, about, you know, having the confidence to jump from one genre to another. And you know, the whole idea, you know, you've covered all the stuff about relationships in the edit suite and how it's so important to cultivate those relationships and friendships within the working environment. And it's just like, it's happening now. So it's fantastic. I loved hearing it. I know a load of our listeners are going to love hearing your story as well, Carly. It's brilliant.
Oh, thank you. And there's one thing I want to add, which I realised was kind of a major part of the last couple of years, which I think is worth saying, just if anyone trying to make that jump.
Please.
So I was also told, as well as being an assistant, that you should edit short films. So I have done a lot of short films over the last couple of years, which are unpaid or low pay. But that was, again, that's sort of something that it felt a bit like, okay, I'm this is my job, but I'm giving up my weekends, my evenings to cut these films. Are they going to go anywhere? But again, that also helped. And I ended up doing a brilliant comedy horror film with a director who then introduced me to another producer who then needed an editor for a film Ashley Walters was directing. It was his first sort of directing debut for Sky Arts. And I ended up being the editor for that, which has then helped, I think, get the agents, which, you know, because it was sort of work on, you know, the short films, they started lower and then they were sort of bigger budgets. And it was then, you know, I had some pieces I could show to my agents, even the short films that were very low budget. I showed her as example of my work and she then sent on for this job as an example of my work. And it was sort of reassuring that actually all those hard, you know, the hard hours working late at night on things for free would pay off as well, and meet, you know, I met some great directors and producers through that as well. So that was just one other side that I forgot to mention, but was very important. And, you know, for people out there, I think it's, I don't think it's always advised, you don't want to be working for free, but I think certain projects, if you then, you know, you will benefit from them long term, it's definitely worth doing. And, you know, those relationships, again, it will always help in future.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you're creating this kind of like momentum, aren't you, with that kind of stuff? And it's not exploitation. You're not getting exploited. It's like these are serious filmmakers doing kind of low budget stuff. And you can tell the difference between, you know, kind of being exploited and actually this is going to be really good for my career. And also, I'd imagine as well, you getting au fait with as much, you know, having done so much like sports stylization, music type cutting and all that kind of stuff, and getting as much drama under your belt as possible kind of gets you reflexive and into the drama kind of consciousness, really, doesn't it, as well?
Yeah, it's been so useful for that. And I think I feel much more confident going into now editing something bigger, because I know I've worked on loads of films with different directors, with different styles, and kind of just practicing, you know, editing is... You know, editing's editing, but the different style, as you say, it's such a everything from the music choices, the pacing, it's so different in sport. So I just was like, I need as much practice as possible. Please let me edit your films. You know, they're all so useful in terms of just, you know, building up that experience and kind of learning to cut in different ways. And yeah, it was a case of kind of slowing things down and allowing things, you know, even just allowing things to breathe a little bit and the pacing. But then also having the energetic cuts are also sometimes useful as well. So I think it was just a good way of combining all those different styles and short films. You know, there's a little bit less pressure and you have a, you know, quite often you don't necessarily have a deadline. So at least you can get it right and really finesse it. So, yeah, I love doing them and I'll probably keep, you know, I do love doing them. I will do more of them in future. They do just slightly take up a lot of your time. So I have to be careful where I draw the line, I think, now, because I was saying this the other day to my fiancé. Someone was asking about our hobbies, and I realised my hobby used to be editing, and now it's my job, and now I don't feel like I do anything else in my life, and so I need to make sure I keep time free to do other things.
You need another
just
hobby.
Just be editing all the time. Yeah, exactly. It's embarrassing, but I do love it, so I feel very, very, very lucky to be able to do that for my job.
Well, listen, Carly, it's been an absolute treat listening to you. Your story is I've never heard anything like it. It's deeply inspiring, and I just want to thank you, and I know our listeners would like to thank you for taking the time to come and talk to us on Once Upon a Timeline. It's been a great session, and I know there's a lot of editors around the world who are going to get something out of this, so thank you so much.
Thank you, thanks for having me on, for all your questions and your kind words. I've really enjoyed it, and yeah, if this can help anyone, then, you know, I'm very glad. So yeah, thank you so much.
Carly's one to watch. I hope you're going to come back. I promise to come back in a year or two, and once you won your BAFTAs and stuff like that and your Emmys, and she'll be back giving us more pearls of wisdom, I'm sure.
Oh gosh, no pressure. I feel like ramping up.
Oh, you love
I'm
pressure.
I'm sure it won't be that. But yeah, I do love the pressure.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Carly. You take care.
Thanks. Cheers.
What a truly inspiring editing artist Carly is. I love her determination to constantly move her career forward, to network, to take risks, to cultivate great relationships, and to push through all that self-doubt. You know, something which we all go through. And don't forget, you can catch her latest work on season 2 of the BBC HBO drama series Industry. Now, as the new year approaches, do you want to take your editing to an elite level? Then our creative editing course was built specifically for you. We've helped thousands of editors, directors, producers, news journalists, social media experts, and marketing pros to become high-end visual storytellers. Our step-by-step course is made up of over 100 tutorials that take you through every single aspect of the art of editing. Learn at your own pace and practice on the 35 hours of free raw footage you receive as a member. We turn you into a powerful, creative editor. That is a wrap for episode 5 of season 3 of Once Upon a Timeline, the Creative Editing Podcast. And a wrap for 2021, dear friends. As always, I want to thank our fantastic partners over at Universal Production Music, who supply every single track for our show. If you like any of these tracks and you think they'd be perfect for something you're cutting right now, as usual, go on over to the podcast page at insidetheedit.com and you'll find all the links and track names so you can license them for your current project. Inside the Edit is a tiny company, dear friends. It's just me and a couple of other passionate people. So please, please, please don't forget to tag us on social. And if our show has helped you out creatively, we'd really appreciate it if you share it with your filmmaking friends. However, if you have 30 seconds to spare, a rate and review on Apple Podcasts is also really, really, really appreciated. Thank you once again for being part of the Inside the Edit community. Have a great holiday season, dear friends, and I wish you and your loved ones a happy and prosperous new year. I'll see you early January on another episode of Once Upon a Timeline. Stay cool, stay safe, stay in the festive spirit, and stay cutting.